Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Podcast, where we explore politics, economics, and culture here in the Midwest Heartland. This show is distributed by WVIK, the flagship national public radio station in the Quad City region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. Today, I'm very, very pleased to have as my guest as a senior senator from the state of Illinois, the Honorable Dick Durbin. Senator, thank you so much for taking some time today.
Thanks, Robin.
Hey, I just saw something this morning where the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said that the lack of providing more recovery help for the economy would have, quote, tragic consequences. Where is this at, and what specific components of a recovery package do you think are most important?
It's not the first time he said it. Jerome Powell is a Republican, conservative, economist, heading up the Federal Reserve. Since we've entered this pandemic economy, for lack of a better term, he has done everything in his power to drop interest rates in an effort to revive investment and capital flow and preserve the opportunity for businesses to weather this storm. He has said to Congress over and over again, I need your help. I can do everything on the monetary side that the Federal Reserve can, but I need your help on the fiscal side in terms of federal investment and federal spending. Initially, March 26, we passed the CARES Act, 96-0, in the Senate. It was a $3 trillion-plus investment in the economy, and I think it frankly saved a lot of businesses and kept a lot of families together who were facing furloughs and layoffs. But nothing since. Our efforts basically expired on July 31st, and Chairman Powell has been saying to Congress over and over again, where are you? When are you going to do something? Understand things could get dramatically worse, and recovery could take a lot longer if Congress doesn't act. It's been over 4 months since Nancy Pelosi passed her HEROES Act. It's been a week now that she passed the second version of it. Senate Republicans have just refused to really take up any meaningful effort to address this. Now we hear the president has an appetite for it, coming into the election with his numbers starting to flag. You can understand why he won a boost. And maybe the conversation starts anew. But if we ignore this at this point, I think the economic recovery is going to be a long way in the future.
Yeah, and the Federal Reserve is out of arrows in the quiver, from what I understand.
Well, they've really gone, you know, they've gone to zero interest rates, which not universally, but for the most part. And they've also stepped in to pick up a lot of the commercial loans and commercial borrowing in the private sector. They're doing everything they can do, and Powell keeps looking at Congress and saying, please, join me. Let's keep our feet on the accelerator.
One of the hang-ups, from what I understand, is assistance for state and local governments. And correct me if I'm wrong, but as I recall, in the Great Recession of the late 2000s, one of the things that kept dragging on the economy was layoffs at the state and local level. And we've got layoffs going on right now in Peoria, firefighters, for example, and other cities across the state.
Well, hold on tight if Congress doesn't come through and help state and local governments. And I'm not talking about pensions. That's a separate category. We're not the only state with that problem, but no one is suggesting there ought to be a federal bailout for that at this point. What we need is help because we lost revenue. You know, states like Illinois can just point to it, and so can the cities and the counties as well. So you could face layoffs of not just firefighters, healthcare workers, teachers, police, people that are critical for putting this economy back on its feet. I mean, people are saying back in the day when we had federal assistance for unemployment, why is it taking so long to process it? Well, because the numbers of people that are making the application are dramatically larger than any time in history. Now, look at what we're facing. If there isn't money coming from Washington for state and local governments, you're going to find a lot of these essential functions to keep families together even slower and people waiting even longer, exactly the opposite of what we need.
You know, instead of going back and critiquing how this has been handled from the beginning of the pandemic, I guess after the events of the weekend, what should the federal government be doing? What should the president, Congress be doing moving forward to get this under control even more beyond just the economic recovery we've been talking about?
Well, I can tell you the basics. First, you need a consistent national message. You need a national leader who is willing to say things that may not be popular but need to be said. You need a national leader who will set an example of what America needs to do to put this crisis behind them. And the three things we absolutely need, first, dramatically more tests than we currently have. You know, if you're taking a test, as I did with my wife a few weeks ago here in Springfield, and they say, we'll give you the results in 6 days. Excuse me, that's not much help. To know that 6 days ago I was healthy or not healthy is interesting data point, but you need more timely testing. And that is something we're way behind. We do about 1 million tests a day in the United States. They say we should be doing 4 million at least, and absolutely optimum of 14 million. We're that far behind. And we need test results that are timely. We should have focused on this as one of the pillars of dealing with this crisis. Second part's therapy, third part vaccine. It appears that everything is pointed toward the vaccine, and the sooner it comes, the better. But let's be realistic. We're not likely to see a widely distributed, safe, and effective vaccine for months. And in the meantime, if we're going to stop the death rate and the infection rate in this country, we need national leadership.
It just seems like whether we like it or not, economic recovery is tied to getting this COVID issue more under control than what it is now.
Totally.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I mean, you can't speak in honest terms about reopening schools or reopening businesses until there's confidence. The confidence of parents that they can send their kids to school and they'll be safe. The confidence of consumers that they can walk into a business and not be exposing themselves to this virus. Those things are fundamental to a recovery. And, you know, the simple fact of the matter is, it's working in other countries. When we look around the world, other countries are seeing a return to normal economic circumstances weeks and months ago. Did you know that the infection rate in the United States is 5 times what it is in Canada? That the death rate is twice what it is in Canada, in the United States? It just is indefensible that we've reached this point.
Senator, you're of course a member of the Judiciary Committee, and in that role you're going to be in the middle of a lot of very, very important issues coming up. One is the issue of the civil unrest we've had, especially in the bigger cities, but in also some other medium-sized cities. What do you see coming up in the legislative hopper, so to speak, that's going to kind of balance effective policing with which also kind of cutting back or incentivizing departments to get rid of the bad apples?
I don't think it's realistic that a measure is going to be passed in the Senate before the election. I'm sorry to say that, because I think there are opportunities we ought to be taking advantage of. Bottom line, there is never an excuse for violence or vandalism in the name of social protest. It's just unacceptable, and I condemn it, and it should be prosecuted. Amen. Point number two is Americans can stand up and speak up, and they should. We're a free country. And if they disagree with policies or want to see changes in policy, if they do it in a thoughtful, peaceful, nonviolent way, they ought to have every right to do so. And we need to do something. You take a look at what we went through in May when the whole world, certainly the United States, held its breath for 8 minutes and 46 seconds while George Floyd died next to the sidewalk there on the curb in Minneapolis. That was such a wake-up call across America. Breonna Taylor, Jacob Blake, all of these names now that have hit the front page of the paper tell us that though the vast majority of people in law enforcement are principled, humane, and do it for the right reason, there are bad apples. There are people who shouldn't be wearing a badge. There are folks who shouldn't be carrying a gun. We've got to do a much better job in training and calling out those who come into this line of work with a prejudice that can't be removed. We've got to deal with the tactics they use, the video cameras, all of the things that give us the kind of transparency in law enforcement to reestablish our confidence.
We live in such unprecedented times with the COVID pandemic, the economic collapse, and then the civil unrest over the summer. And now comes the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. As a member of the Judiciary Committee, again, you'll have a front row seat. How are you approaching that as far as giving her, an opportunity to be heard, but also in light of what happened to the Merrick Garland nomination?
Let's concede the obvious. She's very smart. She has really worked her way up to the position of professorship at Notre Dame Law School, clerk on two levels of federal courts, including the Supreme Court, and now a member of the Circuit Court. There's no question that she is well-versed in law and defends her position on many issues with a real expertise. Having said that, the basic question in my mind is she a change agent on the Supreme Court? And if so, what does that change mean in terms of the American people? I think it really gets down to the first and threshold question, the future of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. We have some 20 million Americans that count on Obamacare for their health insurance, over 100 million people with pre-existing conditions of some kind who are protected now because of Obamacare. It's on the chopping block. The president, his administration, his attorney general, and 16 Republican state attorneys general have said they want to abolish it with no replacement. That is the first item of business, the first item on November the 10th for the Supreme Court. And this justice, if it's Amy Coney Barrett, will be sitting in and listening. Sadly, she has written articles which make it abundantly clear that she is opposed to the Affordable Care Act. She wants to see it gone. And that's why so many people are in a hurry to put her on the court. That would create a real vacuum in terms of health care in the middle of a pandemic. I worry about that more than anything.
I've heard you say in other interviews that you'd rather not focus on the calls by some in the left to add more justices to the court if Joe Biden's elected and the Democrats take over the Senate. And I respect that. But there does seem to be a lot of pressure also to provide Puerto Rico with statehood, Washington, D.C. with statehood, to take some extraordinary measures here. How are you going to balance those calls from the far left with also the respect for our existing institutions and processes we have?
I've been for D.C. statehood since I was first elected to Congress. It's just inconceivable to me that 700,000 people living in Washington, D.C. do not have voting federal representation. I've never understood it. If it made sense at one point in their history, it doesn't make any sense to me today. The future of Puerto Rico is hotly debated in Puerto Rico as to whether they will even seek statehood. So I'm not assuming that that is as ripe an issue as the future of the District of Columbia. No, I think this is a basic matter of justice. These people deserve a voting voice in the United States Congress, and I will support D.C. statehood.
You're listening to Heartland Politics here on WVIK. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is the Honorable Dick Durbin, senior senator from the state of Illinois. So, you know, Senator, I was going back. You served quite a while and had a distinguished career. excuse me. You were in the House 14 years. You've been in the Senate now 24 years. What's motivating you to come back and run for another six-year term?
That's the very question my wife asked me. She said, why would you run again? And I said to her, I think January 2021 is going to be one of the most remarkable months in American history. I'm supporting Joe Biden. If he's elected president, we have work to do. We have got to change what's happened in Washington, not completely, but in many aspects. And we've got to really chart a new direction for this country. First and foremost, we've got to start to unite this country. It is more divided than I have ever seen it. I think Joe Biden has the temperament and the judgment and the respect to start us in that national conversation. I want to be part of that. Secondly, we've got to move forward to get this economy out of the ditch, to get the coronavirus epidemic under control. And I think Joe Biden's setting out to do it. I want to be part of it. And third, you know, I've been there for a while. There's no question about it. I have seniority. Number two in the Senate as the Senate whip. And also the ranking Democrat on the largest subcommittee of the Appropriations Committee. What that means is I sit at the table where decisions are made. That doesn't mean that I personally have value in that regard, but the state of Illinois has a presence at that table. I want to make sure our state gets its fair share. We send lots of money to Washington. I want to bring as much as possible home to our state, for so many parts of it need a helping hand.
Senator, you've been around a while, I have too, and I ponder this next question quite a bit. But how did we get to this point where even wearing a mask has become a political issue? It seems to have built up over the years. There's a lot of different theories from the left and right, but what's your take on how do we come so hyper-partisan in our country and so at odds with each other?
Well, we were certainly headed in that direction for a variety of reasons. The way we finance campaigns, the new social media information for the American people. You know, there was a time not that long ago when there were three or four major networks and people tuned into the news at 6 and 10 in the Midwest to find out what the news was. Well, now it's a different world completely. You're being informed constantly, sometimes with the truth and sometimes not. And that's a phenomenon in this country. But I will tell you, it sounds partisan, but I'm just going to lay it on the table. I think this president has given permission slip to some of the more extreme people in our society who are financed, funded, and inspired by conspiracy theories and fear and hatred. It just doesn't work in our democracy to do that and expect to have bipartisanship where we need it. We've got to have a different tone, a different temperament when it comes to the president of the United States. Even his strongest supporters, and I serve with a lot of them, say over and over again, gosh, we wish he wouldn't tweet. Well, what did he do in the hospital at Walter Reed? 25 tweets or something. He can't stop himself. And so many of those are divisive and just keep this whole situation in our country roiling instead of bringing some common purpose, some direction, some leadership when we need it.
I see another committee that you're on is the Rules and Administration Committee, which, if, correct me if I'm wrong, oversees elections and election security, and that's another huge issue that's come up. I just saw today, you know, our election system in the United States is decentralized. It's not run out of Washington. It's a state and local responsibility, as you know. How do you feel? I mean, is your committee taking preparations for chaos in the election results as a, because of mail voting to some degree, but also interference by other countries like Russia or Iran or China?
Take a look at what we know today, talking about the first week in October. Here's what we know. We have had 2 million people ask for paper ballots to mail in Illinois. We expect somewhere south of 6 million to vote. It could be half of the votes will be cast by paper ballot. Now compare it to 4 years ago. It wasn't 2 million. It was 400,000. Five times the number at this moment, and people can still request ballots, you know, for weeks to come. So it's going to be a dramatic change in that regard. The federal government should have stepped in the midst of a pandemic when people don't want to go to the polling place, want to stay in the safety of their homes. We should have stepped in with help for these election authorities. They're facing a real challenge. We may not know November 3rd, that night, unless it's a landslide. We may not know who the winner is for several days or maybe even longer. So I'm worried about that. Secondly, I'm worried about the trend in this country we find in so many states that is suppressing the vote of Americans who should legally be allowed to vote. I'm one who's been reluctant to introduce any proposals for constitutional amendments. But several weeks ago, I said, that's it. We have got to have a federally, constitutionally guaranteed right to vote in America. It doesn't exist. Right now, as you mentioned, decentralized, 50 states and a lot of jurisdictions within those states make up the rules. So I think we need to move to a point where it is a fundamental precept of being an American citizen that if you are legally entitled, you're going to be voting. And we're going to do everything we can to make it easy on you to make your choice in this democracy.
I want to get back to a few economic issues because that's usually what I try to focus on most, but because of the times we're in, these other issues have arisen. But some of the mainline economic issues that have been hitting our area of the state and the country. I read recently where, as you're aware, there seems to be some type of political transformation going on where the Democrats are attracting more educated voters, particularly women voters, while the Republicans seem to be pulling away some of the white working class voters that used to be in the Democratic FDR coalition. And a lot of these folks, you know, feel like the Democrats don't have a message for them. And 9 of the 11 Obama-Trump counties are right here in northwestern Illinois. What's your message to these folks that might have crossed over and voted Republican to get them back to what the Democrats have to offer?
I think that vote by the Obama-Trump voters, I've never heard it characterized like that, but I sure understand what you're talking about. I think it reflects people who see two things. First, they don't believe the politicians are listening to the real issues they face with their families every day. And second, they think this economy is fundamentally unfair. Their fathers and grandfathers before them with a strong back and a good work ethic can make a good living and raise a family with kids who might end up in college and have a different future. They just don't think the politicians are listening to that. And I think that in their frustration and anger, many of them switched over from Obama, who said he would bring change, to Trump, who said he will bring even more change. And I think we have to be real about this. And we have to be real about the real jobs of the future. You know, I look at some of the great employers in northwestern Illinois. John Deere is an example, you know, which for years people went to work there. They didn't need a college education. They just need to be trained for specializations at the plant and have a good work ethic. the company made a profit, the workers brought money home, and they built the middle class in that whole region. I mean, that's just one illustration. What is the job of the future? What are we moving to in the future when we have fewer people on the assembly line at John Deere? What are we looking to? Well, let's state the obvious. We're moving toward electric vehicles. There's no question about it. And as we move toward those vehicles, there are going to be people that need to build them. We're going to have a plant in Normal, Illinois, for example, Rivian, that's going to be building them. And the batteries that have to be part of their future. But there's more to it. You know, I keep going to my friends in labor unions and saying, who is looking developing a skill and a trade when it comes to electric charging stations? With more cars and trucks that need to be charged, you're going to see a lot more charging stations in parking garages, on the street, next to restaurants, next to big box stores. Who's doing that? Why aren't we developing a skill? That's something where, with the skill, I think you can get paid a decent salary and raise a family. We've got to be moving toward the future, the renewable fuels. We're down to 18% of electricity being generated by coal in the United States. Coal, by judgment of the private sector, not by government mandate, is not as popular as it once was. And what are we going to do in terms of these new sustainable, renewable energy sources and the jobs that come with them?
We've just got a couple minutes here left, and I wanted to close on another issue that on the Judiciary Committee you'll be in the middle of, and that's this emerging issue of the role of antitrust enforcement in our economy, especially with these huge companies. As you know, you're a member of the Ag Committee in the agribusiness sector and in the tech sector. Are you looking at, is there serious legislation there to break up some of these companies, and how do you see that as critical to helping Main Street businesses, especially in small towns, rural areas across the state?
Well, I would just have to tell you, I think the whole antitrust effort in the United States has really petered out over the last few decades. It really is not as vigilant as it once was. And many of these companies are combining, merging, and suppressing competition at the expense of consumers across America. I'll give an example. Chuck Grassley and I have been talking about folks that raise livestock in Iowa and in Illinois, and talking about the marketplace where they sell their livestock. We think there needs to be much more transparency, much more openness there, and much more competition than currently is the case. And I think that's one example that hits home right in your listening area. But it's across the board. You know, whether we're talking about the giants, the Apples, the Googles, all of the social media companies and the like, or whether we're talking about Amazon and the impact that it's having on retail America, we have got to have a government that says it's okay to be big, it's okay to be successful, but it's not okay to suppress competition. We want to have competition for the good of the consumer and for the honesty of the system. I don't think there's enough of it.
Senator Dick Durbin's been our guest here today on the Heartland Politics podcast. Senator, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of a busy, obviously busy schedule with everything going on, plus your reelection campaign. Thank you very much.
Robin, I hope everybody listening stays safe and healthy and votes. Thanks very much.